This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
1 in 7 people on this planet live in extreme poverty right now. They will need plenty of carbon to develop before they can buy anything like electric cars or solar panels. But what if I told you billions of people could get enough food, health care, and education without adding a single new power station, without an increase in national emissions? Experts who looked into it say it could be done. Energy Requirements for Decent Living in India, Brazil, and South Africa is the title of a new study published in the journal Nature Energy. We reached the lead author, Dr. Narasimha Rao, Assistant Professor of Energy Systems at the School of Forestry and Environment Studies at Yale University. He is also affiliated with the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Laxenburg, Austria. From Massachusetts, Narasimha Rao, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
In a 2018 paper, you wrote, more than 60 million homes in India are unfit for decent living. Replacing this stock with decent housing will entail significant costs and increased energy consumption and related CO2 emissions. Can we house those millions of people in India without a dangerous new load of greenhouse gas emissions?
And so, yes, it is possible to fill the housing gap in India, which is about 50 to 60 million, either slums or substandard units, without a significant impact on climate. And let me explain why I say that. If we just put this into the context of energy demand in the globe, if we think about the average in industrialized countries to be about 65 gigajoules per person, that's a unit of energy. In comparison to that, we have found that in India, we would require on the order of 12 to 17 gigajoules per capita to provide the entire basket of basic living standards, including housing, transport, and several other amenities. And that is well within the energy consumption today in India per person. So, and we've also found in this research that through better construction practices that use local materials, the extent of that increase would be even less and potentially even cost saving. And we found this to be the case as well in Brazil and South Africa, which have much smaller gaps. But in general, the point is that we found out for the first time that the amount of energy that we require for these basic living standards are not a significant increase and just almost a rounding error with respect to the amount of energy that's consumed in industrialized countries today.
And in an earlier paper, you found out that something called stabilized earth blocks as a local construction tool can save a lot of energy. Can you just take a couple of seconds to tell us what that is?
Yeah, it's instead of the traditional reinforced concrete blocks that are used in multi-story buildings, this is a variant of that that is made from a local earth, but it's reinforced and cured to be solid and durable. It's therefore called a stabilized earth block. And we found it can reduce energy use for its construction by about 20% compared to the conventional technology or compared to masonry for building homes, which is the norm for India right now.
I've traveled up and down India by train, and it all works. What about Brazil, though, and its transport system? Are there different problems to look at there?
So the main problem from a development perspective is that in rural areas, the roads are of very poor quality. But in general, the standard of living in Brazil is much higher than that of India, and it's a very car-dependent economy. Almost the entire transportation system is based on cars and buses and not much rail, which is in stark contrast to India. So the impact of that on climate change is that the energy intensity, that means the amount of energy you need per unit of transport traveled, is much higher in a car-dependent economy than in one that has a lot of public transit. So if you compare India and Brazil for the same amount of mobility that we have assumed as a basic minimum, you find that Brazilians are consuming significantly more energy because they achieve that mobility requirement with cars, whereas it's a mix of different modes of public transport in India. So there isn't exactly much of a development problem except for the poor quality roads, but it is a more significant impact on climate. If Brazilians were to, for example, install dedicated bus lanes and encourage greater use of buses on those roads, that could actually reduce energy use quite significantly.
is there still a serious poverty problem in Brazil?
Sure. I mean, Brazil is a fairly unequal society, and you have a large number of slums or favelas, and the living conditions aren't always acceptable from the perspective of what we found to be a basic living standard. So the income in Brazil is maybe about $10,000 to $11,000 per capita U.S., but still you find a lot of homes. We found, I think, a gap of about 5 million homes that are substandard in Brazil. And you also have some that don't have adequate sanitation facilities. So they would have most of the other amenities that we include in the living standard. And probably in the next 20 years or so, there wouldn't be much of a gap left. But we did find in housing and sanitation that there is a gap.
Well, sure, we should talk about what do you define as a decent living standard. I mean, it's going to be different for someone in Canada. I might think I'm really quite poor because I'm on what we call welfare here or something like that. But I would be rich compared to many people, millions of people in the countries that you studied. What is a decent standard of living?
Right. Yeah, that's an important question. And we have tried to be more comprehensive than other poverty indicators thus far. There have been multidimensional poverty indicators that try to make more transparent the deprivations people experience rather than just speaking of an income poverty, which tends to be very context-dependent. And we've drawn from actually ethical theories and social policies about what would be a universal standard of human well-being in a more abstract sense. And then we think about what is the material basis for that basic human well-being. It's not sufficient to ensure people have well-being, but it would be an essential requirement. And that's what we define as this decent living standards. And it includes some of the more conventional requirements that people would understand, such as food, water, clean sanitation, a shelter. But we also include things like mobility, having access to motorized transport of some kind, because that increases the options that you have for livelihood and for getting to a hospital and school, for example. And then we include health and education, of course, and having health care accessible. And probably one aspect that is much more characteristic of the modern society is that we also find from theory that people want very much to have social affiliation, to be part of community. And we have thought about the material enablers of that in modern society. And so we include things like access to the internet and having a cell phone and having some device at home that allows you to access the internet. And those end up being quite trivial in terms of energy requirement, but they are an important part of the basket. And then refrigerators in the home as well, and electricity access so you can have lighting. These are all the fundamental elements. We also have a twist on the existing elements that are known in policy, such as food. We don't think of food as just calories, but we think of adequate nutrition, which might have a very different implication for the appropriate diets that people have, and also makes us cognizant of things like overconsumption and obesity that result from too many calories.
Yeah, I was surprised from your study how affordable the really important things like education and like health care and even food can be compared to what you call mobility, getting around by cars mainly or by trucks and all the things that are trucked in, so that we could at least institute those things that make life worth living without blowing up the carbon.
Yes, absolutely. And just to be clear, when you say affordable, we've done this analysis really only in terms of energy, not in terms of money. But yes, providing health care and education and even some basic amenities like conditioning your home to comfortable temperatures turns out to be quite trivial. And that was an insight of our study. And perhaps to provide some insight to listeners as to why that is the case, if you think about healthcare and education, you tend to have these are shared facilities. A lot of, you know, thousands or hundreds of people use these individual facilities. So when you think about their material requirements per person, it ends up being much, much less than when you think about things like your home, which every household would be expected to have. So, yeah, it was a very important insight that some of the most important basic social services that we ought to provide people, basic healthcare, education, a safe home, is not a major impact. Really, it's the very large homes and very energy-intensive modes of transport are really the biggest areas that we can potentially make a big impact on climate or potentially save if we are more modest in our requirements and our lifestyles.
Why did you pick South Africa as the third case study about the climate cost of getting out of poverty?
Well, I mean, we wanted to do many more countries than just three, but we had the resources for just a handful, and we wanted to pick countries that were, first of all, in different regions where there are many countries with a lot of poverty. And so we wanted at least one important country in each of the continents where you see poverty. So one in South America, Brazil, one in South Asia, India, and in Sub-Saharan Africa. We chose South Africa. It also is a country that is highly unequal, but has a fairly decent, it's a middle-income country. And there's also data available. So that's many reasons led us to choose that country. We do plan to scale this up to other countries now that we've done these pilot studies. And countries such as Nigeria, for example, or Indonesia, China, are all extremely important to find patterns across the developing world so we can actually make some statements about poverty eradication globally and its impact on climate change.
I've spoken with a couple of energy experts from India, and they seem to say the new coal plants in construction and planned there will not provide power for the 600 million Indians still without electricity. It's more for air conditioners and goods for the middle class, mostly living in big cities. So it's hard to get that dynamic where we actually do apply the carbon budget that's left to the people that need it most.
Yes, indeed. This is another important insight from the study. I mean, this is largely an equity issue. It's a justice issue. It's a matter of allocating resources where they're needed most. And that applies both within these countries, such as the example you gave, that from our study, we find that the bulk of energy used today is really supporting a middle-class and affluent lifestyle more than it is serving the most basic needs of people. And so that, you know, that change in a more in a direction of more equitable distribution would, in fact, have a positive effect on climate. But the same thing applies across countries. If you think about the extent to which we in the industrialized countries are consuming energy well above what is required for a basic living standard, and that if you had things like access to better technologies, affordable clean technologies in developing countries that are not even yet making a big dent in the industrialized countries. If you do have access to those affordable technologies, you could also potentially even lower the amount of emissions you need even just to meet those basic living standards. And that's another point that's important to understand is that in the international efforts to try and reduce carbon, we need to think about equity across countries as well.
Did I understand you correctly that you were saying that to provide a decent standard of living in these very populous countries, we don't need to add more energy than they already currently produce? That seems unbelievable. Did I get it right?
Well, I wouldn't put it exactly like that. What we found was if we look at the total amount of energy hypothetically one would need to provide everybody with the basic living standard in those countries, yes, it is well within the amount of energy demand today that is being used in society, which primarily goes to serve the middle class and affluent parts of the society. However, it is probably not realistic to expect that these countries can all of a sudden transform to direct all future energy use only to the poor and their needs. And so there's always been inequality in societies, and one would expect that you can perhaps expect some direction of change towards more equitable development, but the main point is to indicate that there doesn't have to be significant growth well beyond what they currently consume, but we need to just be cognizant of the fact that there needs to be more equitable distribution in the future so that future growth can serve those basic needs as a priority.
I'm struck by echoes of your work in things like the voluntary simplicity movement or transition towns. There are some people in the West who are trying to use less in order to make that margin that others will need to get their decent standard of living. Do you see a parallel there?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly the kind of movements we need in the industrialized countries. Tiny homes and in other communities like the fire community, and there are many communities that are looking to live sustainably using only local resources. And that's exactly the way you put it is the way we need to think about it. In some ways, if we want to achieve our most ambitious goals for climate mitigation, there's sort of a zero-sum game at play here globally. And the extent to which we can discipline our consumption, we do create that room for achieving living standards in other countries. And I might add that I think that that can happen in a manner that does not really hurt our well-being as much as perhaps the current perception suggests.
I think that the harshest people are secretly thinking inside themselves, well, if we have no remaining carbon budget, perhaps it's best if the people who are poorer stay in their local villages without transportation and live from local lands if they can, so that we can go on living the way that we're living. But that kind of injustice just isn't going to make it in a world where everyone can communicate and see how each of us is living. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I have two thoughts I might express. One of them is, you know, developing countries are not going to do that. They're going to want to grow and afford the inhabitants a certain lifestyle. And so what will happen if the industrialized countries don't lead by developing the technologies we need or by reducing consumption, the developing countries will just blow through, you know, the energy growth, and then we will just not meet those ambitious targets. I don't expect that those developing countries are going to all of a sudden stop meeting those basic needs. So that's one aspect of it. And I certainly feel that this has some practical implication, because if you think about the Sustainable Development Goals that were promulgated in 2015, one of them is to provide energy access globally to people, access to electricity and access to clean cooking. You know, there is in some portions of those efforts thinking about providing electricity access to people with, you know, lighting and phone charging using solar home systems and other types of configurations. And it's important to think that lighting and phone charging is only the start, and that as they develop further, you need to support a longer-term sustainable, you know, energy infrastructure for these people and not just think about energy access in terms of just a light bulb and a phone charge. So, yeah, I think that's a very relevant point, that we understand the growth that's required, and really for people in the industrialized countries to understand how globally interconnected we are in terms of our material use and the impact on the environment.
So when government representatives and experts meet at the conference of the parties in the climate summits, how can they draw on your new work?
Right. There are three aspects that need to be discussed typically in these negotiations. One is mitigation, that is trying to take stock of where we are with regards to all of the countries' nationally determined contributions, and then make the next set of pledges, which are expected to be more ambitious. There's adaptation, which is dealing with the impacts of climate change. And third, there is the means of implementation. And that's where I think that this work may have some practical significance, which is we can now perhaps evaluate and assess countries' intended contributions or intended actions to mitigate climate change using this one lens as an input. That is, to what extent are these efforts targeted towards the poor? To what extent are the needs, those basic living standards, being protected? And perhaps we can have now a basis to look at the comparability of different countries' efforts by looking at the extent to which they relate to these basic living standards. So I think that's one way we can take that into account. I think in the slightly longer term, when we have more research for the global implications of poverty eradication, I think this does provide some teeth to these concerns about common but differentiated responsibility, which is kind of the underpinning of the climate agreement, is that we find a way to provide developing countries with equitable access to development in some ways that they can protect their development needs. And now I think we have perhaps one way to actually quantify those development needs in terms of energy. And that is very useful because it provides a concrete way to assess the extent to which countries' mitigation actions are impinging on these basic needs.
What drives you personally to do the research you do?
Well, it's primarily a sense of justice. It's a desire to pursue justice in our development. But the other aspect I might add is that this problem is a very complex problem. It involves the use of many disciplines. It involves drawing from economics, drawing from engineering and energy systems, but also drawing from ethics and morality. And I think this makes it very difficult to generate problem solutions that are practical and ethically driven and understandable to people. And so I really felt that I had something to offer in terms of developing sort of practical solutions, what I call practical ethics. You know, actual solutions that are driven by sound moral principles. And I felt my skills lent themselves to that. And so that's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
And as we finish up, what are you working on next?
Well, there's many research directions that stem from this particular work itself. As I mentioned, we're trying to scale this up for the whole developing world. What are the energy needs across all different kinds of countries? And then one might think about other resource requirements that could constrain our development. So if we use this basic living standard as a foundation, we might think about to what extent are we constrained in terms of cement or water, other resources, rare minerals that may be coming from very particular countries in the world. And so I would like to develop a broader characterization of some of the resource implications of poverty eradication more broadly beyond just climate change, because I think we're facing many other types of environmental impacts and constraints as well. So that's an important part of my work. I'm also thinking a lot about ways that developing countries can both adapt to the impacts of climate change as well as mitigate climate change. And housing is a very important example of that, where building better homes for poor people can reduce energy use compared to what they would otherwise, as well as make their homes more resilient to heat stress and other types of climate impacts.
We've been speaking with Dr. Narasimha Rao. He leads the new paper, Energy Requirements for Decent Living in India, Brazil, and South Africa. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.